Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Linda Fairstein, who reads from and discusses her riveting new book, Death Dance, published by Scribner. In the weeks to come, we have Dave Barry, Julian Barnes, Jill Connor Brown, John Hodgman, Sister Helen Prejean, Adrian McKinty, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a moment, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover. Thank you for supporting your independent bookstore, and thank you for turning your cell phones off. Tonight's guest is a familiar face to the Tattered Cover, having signed her books in our other stores. This is her first time at Highlands Ranch. Besides being the best-selling author of seven previous Alexandra Cooper novels, she has also written a nonfiction title, Sexual Violence, Our War Against Rape. Currently a media consultant for three major TV networks, she was the chief prosecutor in the Manhattan District Attorney's Sex Crimes Unit for 25 years. She is considered one of America's foremost legal experts on sexual assault and domestic violence. Tonight, she will be reading from and signing her latest Alexandra Cooper novel, Death Dance. Please join me in giving a warm Tattered Cover welcome to Linda Fairstein.
Thank you so much both for the gracious introduction and the welcome to this really wonderful new store. My first book, the nonfiction book, was published in 1993, and to be invited then to Tattered Cover as a new author was the thrill of a lifetime, and has always had the reputation of being the best independent bookstore, as I said in the car in front of my grandson today, west of the Rockies. And he said, no, it's east of the Rockies. Okay, so geography was not the strong suit, but it was such a thrill and an honor to be invited then and to do my first event at the main Cherry Creek store, and then to watch it grow into Lodo. Then to hear about this store, to see it tonight, is just beyond remarkable, this big, glorious space filled with great books. And it's so important. It's, I think, important to all of us who write. There's just a Mystery Writers of America online board discussion now of the importance of independent bookstores and how difficult it is to maintain them and see them thriving. So I'm grateful to you for coming, those of you who are near here, those old friends who are coming from downtown to see me here tonight. It's an honor for me. Bless you. And I'm here to talk about Death Dance, which is exactly 1 week old. It only launched last Tuesday, exactly a week ago, so it's still like the new baby, as someone just said to me. It's just a thrill to be out in the world. And also, I'm going to start in backwards order with Entombed, which is last year's book, and it only appeared today in paperbacks, the first time it's been seen anywhere. And I'll just let you in on a little publishing secret. If you look at it and compare it to any of the other paperbacks in the store and on my own list, you'll see that it's about 3/4 inch taller. And some of you may have guessed the reason why, and some may not. It's a new publishing device. We baby boomers are responsible for this because we began complaining, apparently, that the print in mass market paperbacks, some of you are laughing and nodding your heads, you're too young to be doing that, but that the print was too small. And so Simon & Schuster, who owns Scribner and Pocket Books, who published me, decided to try an experiment and make the books taller with larger print so that they didn't expand the pages or the volume, but they've expanded the print. And it's very controversial because some of the places that should not be selling books, like supermarkets, it doesn't fit in their sort of assigned rack. And once again, Tattered Cover has made room for me in this beautiful display. So that's the reason the odd size book. Death Dance is the eighth novel in the Alex Cooper series. And some of you may know, I've sort of self-branded. What I began to do in the second book of the series was to use New York City really as a character in the books. And I became consciously attracted to the idea of taking some place that was very familiar to me and some place that I liked to be and seemed very safe and benign after working at the DA's office, but unlayer it and get behind the scenes, inside the door, above ground, below ground, sort of explore what the place was and find just all the nefarious doings behind these places that looked so either safe or very refined and elegant. And this book is the first one that's actually drawn in many respects from an actual case. I've used a lot of my professional experience, 30 years as a prosecutor, to draw on motives and characters and some of the scenarios really loosely removed from an actual case. But this has its roots in a case that happened when I was a young prosecutor in 1980. So I will start with the true but really tragic story because it's why I kept coming back to the idea of doing this. You will see from what I think is a very attractive book jacket. I have nothing to do with the jacket design. The art director is terrific. This is Lincoln Center, for those of you who might recognize it, the Metropolitan Opera House in the background. And I joined the DA's office in 1972. In 1980, there was a murder that happened inside the Metropolitan Opera House. The Berlin Ballet, which had at the time a really world-class ballet company, had a guest artist named Valery Panov. He was one of the defecting Russians who was quite famous at the time. And I had gone that week to the ballet, to the Berlin Ballet, to see him. And several days later, like everybody else in New York, was stunned to read in the newspaper that a 30-year-old violinist who was in the Metropolitan Opera company, in the orchestra company, had disappeared in the middle of an actual performance at the Opera House. And nobody could believe it. Her name was Helen Hagness. She was 30 years old. She was a first violinist in the company. And between the second and third acts, she left her seat in the orchestra pit, as everybody does, and she took her violin, put it on the chair, and went backstage. She was going backstage for a particular purpose. Her husband was also a performing artist, and he wanted to do a project with Valery Panov. So she was going to try and find Mr. Panov backstage in his dressing room. She never came back for the third act. And what seemed appalling to me when I read about it in the papers and then heard about the case in the office, the woman behind her returned to the seat, and as the conductor tapped his baton on the podium, there's no sign of Helen, the lights were dimming, so the woman behind her just moved up a seat, took the violin, stowed it under the seat. Nobody whispered to anybody else, "You think Helen's sick?" Nobody even considered foul play. I mean, it was the Metropolitan Opera House, it was a full house, but you might think somebody want to check and see if our friend is okay. Nobody did. The orchestra played on, the third act ended. Friends talked about it, some of the women in the orchestra talked about it, but did nothing about it. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, the husband, Helen Hagness' husband, called the local precinct to say that his wife was missing, and did they have any idea, would they help find her? Police departments don't take missing persons reports for people who just disappear in safe places. You'd have to say somebody was seen being abducted into a car or somebody appeared with a weapon and did something. So nothing that the NYPD did wrong. They just said, I don't know what they told the husband, I don't remember that, but the assumption was she must have gone off for a drink or a liaison with someone else and told him to wait till the next day. The next day, he and the police were in contact, but still, it's very unusual before 48 hours for somebody to take a missing persons report. And after 48 hours, when it was clear that there was no sign of Helen, when actually her coat and other belongings were still inside the opera house, people began to assume she never left. The police did a top-to-bottom search, and in that third day, Helen's body was found in an air shaft within the opera house. She had been attacked. She had resisted a sexual assault. She had been killed and bound, actually, with rope and thrown into the air shaft. For a very brief, less than 24 hours, well, in the first 24 hours after the police took the case seriously, my unit was involved, the police came to us because the off chance was that perhaps there was a sexual predator who had been in the neighborhood and wanted to see the records of people we were working with. Were there any patterns? Were there any recidivists? It's a very common thing for the police to have done in the investigation, and that was my original involvement. When her body was discovered, the head of the trial division in my office, who was a good friend of mine, actually took over the investigation and tried the case. It turned out for the police to be not such a difficult investigation for the first simple reason: when this rope was found on her body, the ties were very unique, the kind of knot that was tied. And I don't know anything about knots, but the way I would tie my shoes or put a package together, it wasn't that kind of knot. It was a very unique to stagecraft kind of knot that's used to hold heavy scenery and objects that are up in the wings, or what's called the fly gallery, to hold scenery back. And the investigation very quickly focused on the fact that it was probably an employee of the Metropolitan Opera House and probably a stagehand or a carpenter, someone familiar with doing that work. So the police quickly focused in. It was 6 years exactly before anybody in our office had ever heard of DNA being used forensically, so DNA didn't play a role in this case. But in the old-fashioned way, there was a pipe, a big steam pipe, next to the air shaft in which the body had been thrown, so that fingerprints were on the shaft, and they actually matched one of the employees. His name was Craig Crimmins. He was a 19-year-old kid from the Bronx. He had worked in the Opera House for more than a year. The stagehand unions, very strong in New York, and it's a very familial union. People pass on, there's sort of a legacy where you can get your nephews and sons and brothers and uncles there. So there was a long family history and involvement at the Met, and he was a 19-year-old kid with a very bad alcohol problem. He had encountered, just by chance, the lost Helen Hagness when she was backstage. She apparently asked for directions, and he took her in the elevator to what he knew was an empty floor at the Met, and when they stepped off the elevator, the assault began. I was then, as a young prosecutor, as a New Yorker, as a fan of the ballet and a longtime subscriber to events at the Metropolitan Opera House, just haunted by the fact that somebody could disappear inside the Cultural Center of New York City without anybody hearing a sound. There were 4,000 people in their seats in the theater that night. There were 500 people backstage at various points during the evening making the show go on. I mean, that's what it takes. And, of course, the most startling thing that I learned during the investigation, just talking to the people who were working on it, when you stop to think about it, the entire opera house behind the curtains is soundproofed and has to be, because the sets that are being moved around, the stages, which I'll explain in a minute, that are being moved around, you've got opera singers rehearsing in rooms off stage in their own little cubicles who obviously can't be heard, shouldn't be heard on stage. And so whatever the struggle was, and it was apparently a fierce struggle, nobody could have heard anything. None of the 4,500 people under the same roof could have heard anything because of the soundproofing. So the case was solved. The trial was successful in every way, except obviously that homicides aren't, because you never get the life back. But I don't think I've ever been to the Met without thinking about this case and sort of wanting to get a glimpse of what happened. And it was very much what drove me to this case. So the story that I tell has nothing to do with those motives and that crime. But for those of you who know Mike Chapman, the detective in the book, he tells that backstory because I really wanted readers to understand and believe that it's possible for this to have happened. A lot of people hearing about this would have as a first reaction, it couldn't possibly be that someone was killed in a vibrant, huge theater and nobody knew about it. So that story is only essential to the plot for letting the reader know that this case really did happen. On a lighter note, and a happier note for the novel, what I do is go back to this setting and to other theatrical settings in New York to, again, try and unlayer from them a lot of what goes on in these places and a lot of the history of the New York Theater, which, as some of you know, is also my self-branding. Now, when I was here, for those of you who have been patient enough to come back, when I was here for the Bone Vault several years ago, I've told the story a lot of times. That's my book that's set in the Museum of Natural History and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And the part that I have retold a lot is that the president of the Museum of Natural History is a young woman lawyer. She was president of Barnard College. She's a good friend of mine. And I read a story in the New York Times saying that there were 50 million human bones in the Museum of Natural History. And that intrigued me. That's really the reason I wrote that book. Why are these people not buried in their family plots? Why are they not with their loved ones? Why are they collecting dust on a museum shelf? And I called Ellen and said, I'd love to come in and do research in the museum and see, find out about all these bones. And she didn't return my phone calls or my emails. And when we finally met in person, she shook her finger at me and said, if you even think about killing someone in my museum, I will never, never talk to you again. And I didn't get in that way. I actually got in through someone. There's a wonderful little mystery bookstore, independent, in New York City called Black Orchid, where I'm a regular patron. And it's smaller than half of this little sitting space. It's just a long, narrow space. It's mysteries, top to bottom. And the owners introduced me to one of their other patrons who was a librarian at the museum, had just quit her job, was moving to Australia, and said, I'll take you in. You know, I'll show you top to bottom. And she introduced me. She said to me, come the day before Thanksgiving because nobody important is there. Everybody's traveling or receiving family or cooking. And she set me up in a meeting with 9 curators, brilliant young PhD candidates, most of them, very serious, scholarly-looking people. I was immediately embarrassed, thinking nobody's going to waste their time talking to a mystery writer. And so with 5 minutes in, I just got to the point and said, if you had to kill someone in your department, is there a way to do it? And everybody had an answer. It was great. And my favorite was a very minor point in the book, not a spoiler, but the young woman who, Margaret Mead, the great anthropologist, had still her office in the Met, in natural history, is still maintained exactly as it was for all the years she kept it. And all of her personal treasures and exhibits from Samoa and the South Sea Islands are there. And everything, she was the first one to speak up, and she said, everything that Margaret Mead brought back is tipped in poison. That's how they killed animals, that's how they killed each other, that's how they hunted, that's how they fished. Everything has poison on the tip of it. And so we all joke, if we drop an arrow or we drop a axe-like thing or we drop anything on our feet, we immediately, we think about where's the nearest hospital because is the poison still active and how we get. So I had a great time doing that research, even though I went in the back door. When it came time to do this book, I decided to start at the top, that all that could happen would be I would be refused entry. And my husband has a very lovely relationship with Beverly Sills, who's a friend of his. And I called the office and asked for Beverly Sills, and she took the phone, and she is as gracious a human being as she is an American treasure. I explained what I was doing, and she said, I'd love to have you see the Opera House. And I'd been, obviously, on this side of the footlights many times, and backstage to visit a few ballerinas, and that's one of my passions in life, but never to the recesses upstairs and downstairs. So Beverly Sills set me up with a tour guide. Now, many of you, there are tours we could all take for probably $1.98, I think, $5 a contribution to the Met. They tour school children, they tour any of us around, and you get to see a lot of the work in progress. The people who do these special tours are for the high rollers. When they're trying to get someone to give about $1 million to the Metropolitan Opera, they set them up with people like this. And this woman who gets a credit in the book, Judy Zecker, was fabulous. She was an opera devotee, and she brilliant about the opera, and I know nothing about the opera. And she knows every nook and cranny, every recess of that opera house. And what I thought was going to be a day of research turned out to be about 5 days of research. I just kept going back. And we went everywhere. Every costume that's used at the Metropolitan Opera House is made in the house. Every piece of scenery is made. You see the Egyptian pyramids being constructed for Aida. You see Parisian street scenes for La Boheme. You see the castles that are the background of Swan Lake and the mountain that breaks apart and disappears in the ballet productions. And so they're in some of the scenery takes up two and three stories of the building, and there are open spaces in the floors, these big crevices, and the floor is almost like a crevice in a glacier, so that they start painting the scenery here, the bottom of the mountain, and then they drop it down two floors and just keep painting up and up. Not my most brilliant description, but I think I do it better in the book, but it's just an astounding place. The Metropolitan Opera has four stages. I mean, it's one of the largest stages in the world, but there are four separate stages, so that while somebody's singing La Boheme, the aria in the garret, is dying over here, on that set is the street scene in Paris, and the set is entirely exactly the same size, and they just sink the garret down below ground. I mean, it literally goes to a floor below on a hydraulic lift, and they just move the next stage over so they don't even have to change the set. They can have a ballet set on the third stage. They can have a football field on the fourth stage, and they move these things around. So it was just a fascinating place to be, and Judy was so wonderful and so warm. She knew everybody, and every carpenter would greet her by name. Every guy painting scenery would say, "Hey, Judy," and we'd stop, and people would tell anecdote. I mean, she'd just say something. There's a little anecdote about Luciano Pavarotti and what his favorite, what he had to do before every opera, what his good luck charm was. And some people read the books and don't care. They're just looking for the pacing and the crime, but I love to put in these little pieces of trivia. And Judy would say, "Tell Linda about Luciano and why he wouldn't go on stage without this." And so the hardest thing is always for me to do is kind of shut off the research and sit down and write. But it was just a wonderful series of days being in this opera house and getting to see everything behind stage. The second setting, because once I was in the theater world, I knew I would travel to different places. City Center is another of my favorite buildings in New York City. It's on West 55th Street. It was built in the 1920s. It's another house that does a lot of ballet. It also does a lot of Broadway revivals. It takes a lot of shows like South Pacific and Kismet and My Fair Lady that aren't restaged again, and for 3 or 4 weeks does productions of them. And it's also kind of the most reasonably priced theater in New York City. And I had no idea why. I didn't know why it was City Center. I had no idea about the architectural significance of it. It was like being hit over the head with a hammer. But it's this fabulous building with a huge dome in New York, and I always wanted to know what's under the dome. You will have to read the book to find out what's under the dome. And the president of City Center is a young lawyer, and I called her, I said, "But I do kill people here. I do terrible things in your beautiful home. Come ahead." And she let me in and was very pleased. She's the first one to have read the book of the professionals, and she said to me, "I'd like to give a copy to everybody on the board." And I said, "There's some strange things that I do under your roof." She said, "But it's such a loving recreation and sort of telling of the history of City Center. I'm happy to have you." So that one had a pretty happy ending. And then I was off to Broadway. And everybody who has anything to do with Broadway theater, actors, you know, chorus girls, whatever, has a favorite theater on Broadway. All the houses are very different. They're constructed at different periods of time. Big, small, you know, some are considered little jewel boxes that only hold a very small theatrical audience. Some hold hundreds and a few thousand people. And I was led around to several of them and became enchanted with one called the Belasco Theater, which is quite an old theater in New York in the West 40s. David Belasco, I had no idea who he was. David Belasco was a great stage producer in the 1920s and 30s. And he built the theater after staging many productions. Some of the most famous actors in America began their careers in his productions. He built the theater as it became more successful. And as I started to do my research, he's a really odd guy, a tremendous womanizer, sort of the second thing in the second paragraph of every description of him. One is theatrical producer, brilliant, responsible for most of great American theater in the 20s and 30s. Second paragraph was terrible womanizer, I mean, awful. And he dressed every day of his adult life in a bishop's collar and black jacket. Now, how that attracted women, I don't know, or what that dynamic was, but there's every picture of him ever taken as an adult is the bishop's collar. So that got my attention right away. It's the theater in which Houdini did almost all of his professional performances. So on the stage itself, if you want to know how Houdini really got out of those boxes, there are about 45 trap doors of different sizes and shapes, and most of his tricks, where he'd be locked into coffins and things, had trap doors underneath so he could get out, untie himself, or be untied and get back in the box or come out another hole. So that was sort of interesting to me. And the thing that David Belasco did that really set the tone for kind of a Broadway odd person was producers have to be in the house several times a week if they're good. They have to see that the cast is fresh and whether the script needs to be changed and what the slow parts are, what the good parts are. So David Belasco solved this problem by building himself a very lavish apartment right on top of his theater. And this had never been done in New York. The theaters were then pretty much standalone buildings of two or three stories with big marquees. And his looked entirely different with this several-story apartment above. His solution for being at the shows was his bedroom was the front and center of his apartment, and it was right over the stage of the show. And he constructed it with peepholes in the floor of his bedroom so that he could walk to the peepholes. Nobody could see him from the stage, from the angle of the peepholes. You couldn't look up, but he could look down and see exactly what was going on from time to time. And the other device he installed was a private elevator in the back of the bedroom, which he was notorious for ferrying showgirls up during the performance and wining, dining, and sort of making love to in the course of the performance. So it was enormous fun to get into the lighter side, since this book started with kind of such a heavy concept, but to get into the lighter side of it and have such a good time in the theatrical world and sort of exposing that. We were talking before I began speaking. I love the research phase, the writing phase, which is at least a 6-month project, and for 4 of those months, writing 7 days a week from sort of early morning if I can. That way when family's around, when company's around, if I knock off on a Wednesday or a Friday to have some entertainment, I'm still writing a good 5 days a week. And the writing is terribly solitary. After the very collegial job that I had, that's sort of what Alex Cooper has, the door is always open. There are a lot of friends around. You make no decisions by yourself. There's tremendous collegiality in the office and, in our case, with the NYPD. The writing was really the hardest thing to discipline myself about doing. It means shutting yourself in a quiet place during the day. It means telling your friends, do me a favor, don't call me. Don't say, let's go for a walk on the beach, or let's go shopping, or let's go for a swim. It means trying to write for as many days, or many hours a day as possible. And for me, the most happy time is when the book comes out of the boxes. It's been there a long time, and it's been cooking and percolating in my mind long before I start to write, when I start to write. And so the moment January 17th, a week ago, when the box is open and it's in stores and people show up and to listen and to talk about it and ask questions is really, for me, the very happiest time. So that is my introduction to Death Dance. I am thrilled to be with you and have so many of you here, and I hope that some of you will have some questions or topics that you want to talk about, and thank you for coming out. Yes, sir. Well, I started writing my nonfiction. The nonfiction book, Sexual Violence, I was asked to write by a publishing company, and I was asked to write it in 1986, and life interfered, and I had some cases that I worked on, so that wasn't written until the early 90s, published in 93. It's a long answer to your question. My first novel came out in 96 is when I started writing fiction.
Were you still in the office?
I stayed in the office. I was, unlike Lisa Scottolini and some of my writer, lawyer friends who hated the practice of law, Lisa's quick to say, and wanted to write books to leave it, I hated to give up the practice. I love being in the DA's office. So from 96 to 2002, I was doing both, and it was really hard for me to leave.
With deference.
Okay, with deference. The question was, after I started writing and began to be known as an author, did I get treated with any better deference in New York and in my office? The flat answer is no. I mean, it's very funny. Friends and loved ones understood and took it seriously. My friends in the office were a riot. I mean, the friends who were close friends supported what I was doing. Nobody thought this was going to go anywhere. I mean, a lot of people write books and they don't get very far. And by the second book, when we'd done a little better, and of course my enemies in the office just wouldn't even acknowledge that we publish books. But by the second and third book, it was a riot with my friends because people would drop by. I'm having dinner with one of these people tonight who would drop by and say, "So I said the funniest thing to Judge Torres today. You know, you think it would make a scene in the book? I can print out the minutes for you." I mean, I got respect only as people either wanted to be characters or wanted something they had done to be represented in the book, which goes on to this day. I mean, some of my best emails are from people in the office saying, "You know, this is the funniest thing that happened. Two of my favorite detectives showed up at Barnes & Noble's." They're young guys who only overlapped a few years, but they do the cold case unit now in New York, all the cold case work. And they've just got riveting, real stories. And one of them is a continuing character in the book. And he loves being it. So he's constantly saying, you know, "If I mail you this report, you know, can I come back?" From 96 to 2002... you get no respect. I mean, it never interfered with anything in court. There was never a juror during that period of time. I wasn't trying as many cases. There were very few that I supervised. I don't think there were three witnesses who came in those 6 years who said, "I've read your books." just absolutely flat. It's a very good, humbling thing, because then you get in the bookstore world and the mystery crime world, which is a wonderfully collegial world, Mystery Writers of America, Sisters in Crime, International Thriller Writers, they're good organizations. And we have our own rock star level. You know, we have Michael Connelly is kind of king, and, you know, we love to read each other's books and collect each other's books. And so there's a little respect that I was a prosecutor because I have the real deal stuff and stories, but much more interested in the mystery writer thing. So it was very schizophrenic for about 6 years to kind of brook both of those worlds, bridge both of those worlds, and odd, very odd. And the DA who gave me permission to do this, when I wrote my first book, I actually had to go to the ethics board, the conflict of interest board of the city of New York, because it was a nonfiction book about real cases, real people, and they have to check for libel and make sure you're not say anything about a case that isn't finished. And so then I went to the DA and said, "Well, now I'd like to do what I've always dreamed about doing, which is write fiction." And the ethics board said, anybody can write a novel. You don't need our permission to do it. It's from your imagination." And I said, had to go to the DA, who I respect enormously and have known for a very long time. And he said, "Absolutely." And I don't think he ever thought that there were going to be more than 10 copies sold. And he called me yesterday on the road and said, "Where are you?" He had a question. He's Robert Morgan, though. He's wonderful. And I said, "Well, I'm in Denver." He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "So, trying to sell books." And he said, he's in charge of the Police Athletic League, which is a wonderful charity in New York that raises money for kids, inner city kids. And he said, "Well, good, we'll come back with enough money to donate more to the Police Athletic League." So he doesn't take it seriously except for that either. So it's been a great combination for me. Yes. It's a very good question, too. The question is, when I'm in the six-month writing period, do I have any trouble sort of keeping the characters in order and trying to remember whether I'd written a line of dialogue or not? Now that I'm writing and trying to be in the pages at least a part of every day, sometimes it's a half hour, but generally from June to October, I can do a good number of hours, a good number of days a week. The other way, when I was writing the nonfiction book, less of an issue because that was almost like a series of essays on different topics, but I wrote four of the novels while prosecuting. And then, obviously, the real-life job took much more precedence over this. People's lives were in our hands every day and decisions that had to be made. And so I could go for weeks at a time without writing. And it was very hard to get back into it and to remember where I was, what the pacing was, exactly what clues I'd laid in. And I always ended up having to start reading myself all the pages over just to get back into the tone. And that takes a lot of time every time you do it and then put it down for 3 weeks or 2 weeks or a month. And now I find writing part of it every day. I think the books are stronger books, if I have to, if I may say it modestly. It's just they're better written because I'm putting so much more time into it, and the pacing is better. The logic is, I think they flow better, and that's a real benefit of sort of being in it every day. the cheating part, I always say, is writing series. Many of you here read a lot of authors who write what are called standalone novels, even in the mystery world, and each book they come back to has entirely different cast of characters. I set out to write a series. I love the novels where you become attached to characters and come back to them like old friends, and you know when they walk out a door whether they're going to turn left or right, take a subway or a taxi, have a Doers or not, or you know whatever the drink is. What I didn't realize, nobody ever said to me, it's like cheating, because when you sit down to write book 5, book 7, book 8 in this case, you know these people, they're fully formed. It's not like creating an entirely new cast of characters for every book. And you know, I have a pretty good sense of what stories have been told that I'm not going to tell them again. I keep little notebooks so that when my friends send me these wonderfully clever things they've said in court and brilliant summation lines, I sort of keep them, and I try and put, you know, a red check next to them when I use them, because some of them are good enough to use again. I don't think I've gone there yet, but it's a real challenge for, I mean, what you'll hear over and over again from mystery writers, any writers, and from, but mostly mystery writers doing these series, and you certainly hear it from critics, is keeping the series fresh, keeping it from getting stale, having the characters grow and evolve in the books and have changes in their personal lives that reflect what they do professionally. So there's a lot to think about doing it, but it's so nice to have a family of characters that I start every project with. Yes, sir. Great series. I love talking about this, and I'm going to be very honest, even though this is my first podcast, which I'm proud to be doing, and I hope my editors don't listen. I've had 3 editors in my career. My husband, Justin, is not professionally, was never meant to be my editor. Was a lawyer, a great litigator, and loves to read as much as I do, but has no, he can edit a great legal brief. He had no practice doing this, but he's the only person who reads my pages before a professional editor does. And he is a very tough critic. He's heard this many times before. This is not a surprise. And you'll see why this is important later, because he is very quick to red line and pencil and this doesn't work for me, or this ending isn't very good. And I kind of have to drag, at the end of a day, when you've done 6 pages or brilliant day, 8 pages, and you're exhausted and the brain's weary and the eyes are going, and you give it to somebody, I kind of like to say, I don't mind the constructive criticism, but if there's something nice, I always say, if there's something nice, like throw me a crumb and say something. And he doesn't always do. He's just, you know, I want these to be better books. And one of the best things came out of his editing of me, which was after the 3rd book, Cold Hit, I think there's a radical change in my style. And I credit it to David Baldacci, who's a terrific writer, a UVA law graduate, as am I, much younger than I, but he's become a good friend and a terrific writer long before that. But Justin was reading one of David's books and said, you know, truly that expression of you can't put it down. He was reading it at night and he was going page, you get to the end of a chapter and he'd say, I can't turn the light out yet, got to read another chapter. And he said, you don't end your chapters with enough tension a lot of the time, and you can't do it every chapter. But he said, you know, you don't necessarily make me in those first 3 books want to read the next page. You'll sometimes think you're saying something clever or you'll have a, you know, a funny scene. And I have a whole turnaround from The Dead House On that I credit to editor number 1, my husband. Now, the first professional editor is a woman who's just world-renowned in the mystery field, and I really think responsible for my career. Her name is Suzanne Kirk. She's one of my dearest friends today. We've just been emailing down to Natchez, Mississippi. She is well-known in this field. She was the first person who read the pages that my agent submitted, the first 93 pages of the draft of Final Jeopardy. She's the one who said to Scribner, we should buy this book and see if this author would like to work with us. The first day I met her for lunch, when I'd only written 93 pages, I just adored her. We became fast friends. She found and bought manuscripts for the first books of Patricia Cornwell, Janet Ivanovich, John Sanford, Greg Iles, I mean, more mystery writers than I can tell you, and is responsible in the most modest, quiet way for just incredible careers. And Suzanne retired after I submitted Entombed. That was the last book of mine, last year's book, that she retired to Natchez, and deservedly has a very happy life there and is a wonderful person. So it was a very, very difficult moment for me when Scribner said, Suzanne and my publisher were both on the phone at the same time to tell me she was retiring and to turn me over to a new editor, and not my choice within the house. There are a lot of great editors at Scribner. They told me who it was going to be, and it's a guy named Colin Harrison, and I'd say Colin's in his 40s. He is in his own right. Don't leave here tonight without The Havana Room or Manhattan Nocturne. He's a fabulous writer, and I knew that, and I'd read his books, and I'd liked them a lot. But I didn't know him, and I was immediately paranoid and terrified, because here's Suzanne, who'd read every word of mine from the first book, who was a very good editor, but a very gentle one. Unlike my husband, she would always say, I like this, this could be tighter, this could be... And just this close friendship that we had. And so here's Colin. A, he's a guy. B, he at that point hadn't read any of my books, was doing a quick catch-up. And three, I really had a little concern about another writer. Would there be competition? Would he be generous or not in his comments? And Death Dance, I mean, he never read, he read the backlist to catch up, but he never saw a page of my writing till the entire, fresh for him to do, until the entire manuscript of Death Dance was given to him. And submitted to him right before Christmas last year. And the day before I left New York to come to Denver, we had a meeting in his office, 5 hours. He took the 420-page manuscript of Death Dance, and we sat on opposite sides of a desk, and we went through it line by line by line. It's a line edit, which most editors don't even do anymore. And it's a huge gift to an author. I mean, he took 400 pages and went through it bit by bit. And off the record, this is why I didn't want this to be podcast, I just fell in love with Colin Harrison. My husband knows, it's all on the record. He is he's just fantastic, and he's very quiet. It's entirely different than Suzanne, and the most generous of spirit for a writer. And as I've said to Justin, my husband, many times, first of all, Colin, there's a check mark next to everything. We're doing the edit, and getting the critical things, and we're into about page 20, and I said, what do these check mark means? He said, oh, the check mark means I like that. If check mark means it's a good line of dialogue, I like what Mike said. I went home and said to my husband, if only you could do what Colin does. I mean, just a check mark every now and then. Just part of the, you know, well, it's never going to happen at my house. But and then, he just takes things, and when he criticizes, the most fun about it, when he says, okay, this... say, now, what do you think? It's not just go back and rewrite it, but he'd say, now, do you think Mike would ever do this? This might make it a little stronger. He's been so hugely, hugely helpful, and it's a relationship entirely different than my relationship with Suzanne. I never dreamed I'd be lucky enough to get a second editor and a man who's such a good writer and yet has the generosity of spirit and intellect to be this kind of partnership. And it's just been beyond my wildest dreams. So I'm grateful to my three editors in different fashion. Yes. Great. Well, that's an interesting question, too. And I've never been asked this. The question is, which one do I think has been the best received by the public? And is it the one that I think should have been the best received? Long answer. It's a really interesting question. There are many people who come to series and come to things like this who are compulsive, like I am. If I find an author, I love to start at the beginning. Now, the books are written so that you can start anywhere. I mean, more people will find Death Dance and have found Death Dance in a week than found Final Jeopardy, the first book. And so they're written so that the new reader can leap right in, meet the characters. You hope they want to go back either to the tattered cover or to the library and read the old ones. But a lot of us like to just start at the very beginning and read Final Jeopardy. It's the first baby. I love Final Jeopardy. Are the later books better than Final Jeopardy? Absolutely, yes. I think to this to this date, probably the Bone Vault was the best received broadly. I think it was my strongest writing book until this, because it was the first book I wrote after I left the office and just hunkered down and spent all the time working on one book. I think the museum theme resonates with everybody in the Northeast. Has, you know, the first place you go as a kid is the Museum of Natural History, and then the Met, you see the dinosaurs, you see. So there's that, and if you're from out of town, you've probably been to one of the museums or you know about one of the museums. So that had a lot of resonance. Entombed, last year's book, for an entirely different reason, so many, because it has a lot to do with Edgar Allan Poe and the life of Poe, it got very serious respect and broader than mystery respect, because it's about one of our great literary geniuses. Now, the part of this answer is what I would like to say is also exciting at the moment, which is when a publisher publishes you, they want each book to do better than the next book. It would be bad if sales went down for a while. And that's happened with each of the books, so each one has been better received. And tomorrow at 3:30 Phoenix time, where I will be, or maybe it's two. Is there a difference between here and Phoenix in time? I don't know. Okay, so thank you. Tomorrow at 3:30 in Phoenix, the publishers will find out 5:30 New York time what the New York Times bestseller list is for the next week. So, books 4, 5, 6, 7, the last four books have made the New York Times list. Each one getting higher, and so this is an enormously exciting time. Death Dance has a larger printing than each of the earlier books, which is as it should be, ideally. It doesn't always happen, but that's working. And so I'll be able to answer that better within the next 2 weeks as nice people come to bookstores. And it helps I've had a very good response, so I get publicity like the Today Show, which a lot of authors can't get. I mean, you have to be a bestseller in many cases to get to those shows. So starting with IMAs, starting with the Today Show, I did Colorado and Company today, and they announced the signing tonight. I don't know if anybody is here because of that, but thank you, and thank you, Colorado and Company. So it's I'm hoping that within a month people will say, gee, I like Death Dance best of Linda's books, and to me it's most like the Bone Vault because it's got this setting that's so, that sort of everybody can connect to or not, if they, whether you've been to New York or not, sort of know about theater and so I hope it has that kind of appeal. We shall see. You'll be the judges. So I don't know if you want to take one more, and then okay, we'll take one more question, please. Okay. I'm so succinct, as you can tell. Great. Oh, really? I mean, all these questions have been great. So I'll repeat them. The first one is, the mystery writing world is very competitive, as just hardcover fiction in general, and then the mystery world, was it hard for me to get published? And then what's the brass ring for me? Is it selling millions of copies, or is it the movie deal or whatever? So the first question was, what was the first question? I'm so tired. Author on book tour, where am I? The first one was competitive. Okay. Yes, I mean, it is hugely competitive, and I think probably the hardest thing that the never-published writer faces is getting read in this day and age. There are fewer and fewer publishing houses. There are fewer and fewer editors. And one of the reasons I like to help young writers, rare for me to leave a bookstore at an event like this without somebody saying, you know, I've got a manuscript. Do you think your agent would look at it, or your editor? And I love to try and put them in people's hands, and things happen. For me, you know, I cheated. I mean, what was really easy was I was asked to write a nonfiction book called Sexual Violence, and when that came out, it was not by any means best-selling. It was, but it was reviewed on the front page of the New York Times Sunday Book Review, and it had it was a New York Times Notable Book of the Year, and it had a lot of respect, not best-selling, but respect as a book. So when I had this desire to do the novel, I have a literary agent who's a great good friend. She was a longtime friend of my husband's, and she didn't represent me on the nonfiction book, and she kept saying when we go out to dinner, stop whining about writing a novel and write the novel, you know, start some pages and let me see what you can do. Everybody, you know, everybody who talks to me wants to write a book. And it was in the tattered cover at Cherry Creek when I was on my sexual violence tour that I walked around. There was a little corner, we probably still have it, but it was writers how to write. There was a novel. I believe the woman's name is Dorothy Bryant, B-R-E-E, odd spelling, and said how to write a novel. And I bought the paperback novel at the tattered cover, and it said things that I never even thought about. Like, you have to think, are you writing from the first-person point of view or the third? Are you writing in the present tense or the past tense? This is how you can organize your character. Use index cards and make different colors for each character. It started in the tattered cover. And the reason that I got read, I mean, it's just no secret, the reason I got into an editor's hands is I had the track record as a published author. I had a track record with a successful, critically successful nonfiction book. They knew I could start and finish, a project. And I had the real job. Everybody was riveted at that point with strong women in non-traditional roles. I mean, it was just a lot of the Paretsky, Cornwell kind of stuff, people breaking through. And the fact that I had the real job helped me get done. I had, not nationally, but in New York, and was known for the work and the editorial people. So that's the reason I like to help people. It was, I don't know that anybody would have read my pages if I just sat home and wrote a mystery and didn't have the rest of the career. So that, I'm very aware that my mysteries were not better. Final Jeopardy wasn't better than anybody else's first book, but it got looked at. So that's where that started. The Brass Ring. For me, it's books and being in the book world. Would I like a movie deal? Yeah, I had a made-for-TV movie deal for the first book, and we bought the option back. Yes, I would like, I would love the movie down the road, but I love books. I started doing this because I like to read and other people's books. I've never left a bookstore without buying books. The idea, still seeing one of my books in the hands of someone who is not related to me by blood or marriage, and who, as I often say, and a sale from like an odd, somebody I don't know went through a cash register. It's still such an astounding thrill to me. It's the world I always wanted to be in, and to walk in a bookstore and see this display, when I walked in tonight, to realize I have a backlist now. I go to these signings and used to show up people and buy the whole backlist and see now that I've got 7 earlier novels. I pinch myself every day. It's really what I wanted to do, and I thank you for giving me that gramble of a question, because it's all about the books. Very short. Well, thank you. Here's somebody who's here. I'll repeat for the podcast because I've been asked to, who has never read me before and is here for some reason. She'll tell me maybe when she comes up, but it means the world to me, and I thank you all for coming out, and I hope you have half as good a time reading Death Dance or any of the books as I have thinking them up and writing them, and I'm very grateful to you all. So, thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Dave Barry, Julian Barnes, Jill Connor Brown, John Hodgman, Sister Helen Prejean, Adrian McKinty, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on January 24th, 2006.